This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 24th of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Section D on Monocle 24 in association with Squarespace. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. It's going to be me, David Pleasant, bringing you the show today. In this episode of the show, we'll be speaking to one of the world's most high-profile architects, Daniel Libeskind, as he reveals the designs for a new tower for Jerusalem.
It's a building that will certainly not overpower the historical texture, but will, I think, enhance the beauty of Jerusalem and its skyline.
Before that, we'll analyse the prolific graphic work of the master American designer Lance Wyman as a beautiful new monograph hits the shelves.
Whether we like it or not, there's a kind of snobbery in design which says, oh, if it's for a mass audience, it can't be good. But he is living proof that it can be good.
Plus, we go to Iceland to meet a women's wear designer with a passion for dyeing fabrics. All that to come, and plenty more besides, right here on Section D on Monocle 24. First up on the show, we're going to delve into the world of graphic design and look at the life and work of somebody who might be called the greatest living graphic designer. Quite an accolade, yes, but the work of Lance Wyman, now in his late 70s, is finally being recognised for its solidity, versatility and constant clarity. Wyman specialised in the graphics of place, placemaking and directional systems, now known as wayfinding. The project that no doubt led to his eventual fame was the commission by the Mexican government to design all the branding and signage for the 1968 Mexico City Olympic Games. Mexico 68, with its stylized font and ingenious patterned Aztec influence, became the textbook Olympic success story in terms of graphics, and still is today referred to every time the games come around, especially by those in the industry unsatisfied by current designs. Well, it seems timely that specialist design publishers Unit Editions should create a beautiful monograph containing virtually all of Wyman's archive. Featuring wayfinding projects as diverse as Jeddah Airport and the Calgary Skywalk, this splendid volume is a vivid celebration of the often media-shy graphics master that is Lance Wyman. A little earlier, I spoke to one of the book's editors and co-founder of Unit Editions, Adrian Shaughnessy.
Well, a big part of what we do with our tiny, tiny publishing company is we try and find those neglected areas of graphic design and visual culture. And Lance Wyman seemed to us to be a perfect candidate for someone who kind of does not get the recognition that he deserves. I mean, for instance, just one example, and there are others, but in America, he's American, obviously, born in New Jersey boy. He's now in his late 70s. And in America, they have a thing called the AIGA Gold Medal. And if you read the list of people who've received this gold medal, the AIGA is the kind of body of for graphic designers, every famous name you could hope is there, but not Lance Wyman. And Lance Wyman did something remarkable in the 1960s. He designed the Mexico Olympics, which is really what most people know him for. And I quite often talk to people, I mention Lance Wyman and they look blank, but then I say Mexico 68 and they go, oh yeah, him, yeah. So when we were looking around for a suitable subject, our kind of main incentive is to find someone who's kind of been neglected. And Lance Wyman seemed to us to be the perfect candidate.
And we'll talk a bit about the actual details of the book and some of the amazing spreads and the archive materials, just bewildering. But going on that theme of perhaps why he's a little bit underrepresented or unknown, but he does seem to be the designer's favourite at the same time. He's often, the Mexico 68 work he did is often kind of the insider's favourite Olympic branding and so on. Maybe tell us why perhaps he might have missed the sort of public appreciation, but is still really appreciated amongst the design community. Yeah. How does that work?
Yeah, it's absolutely right to say there is a kind of body of informed graphic designers who know him. So I'm not saying he's unknown by any means. I just think the wider recognition has not been forthcoming. And I've got some couple of thoughts on that. But there are certainly fanatical Lance Wyman people. And we've produced, there's two versions of our book. One is a deluxe version that comes in a slipcase. And there's only 150 of those. And they've sold. We've sold them all. We haven't even got the book in our hands yet. But
probably every creative director in London and beyond has already bagsied one of those copies.
Exactly, yeah. And certainly beyond, because we get orders from Chile and places like that. And we only sell our books on the internet, so we know who's buying it. And we see some interesting names. So you're absolutely right. He has a strong, very, very strong following. But it's surprisingly small, and you still meet really smart people who know their design history, but Lawrence Wyman, for some reason. My theory on all of this, if you were to say, well, on a scale of recognition, Paul Rand is 10 out of 10. Everybody knows Paul Rand. Lawrence is probably about 3 on a scale of recognition. And my theory behind this is that everything he did, you've alluded to the fact that there's a great range of work, everything he did was for a mass audience. So a lot of the designers that we look up to, you know, the Swiss guys and people like that, they did these beautiful little art projects for tiny, you know, Swiss publishing houses, and they're wonderful. Lawrence did it in the street. You know, he went and did these massive zoo identity jobs, really major, major projects, but always for a mass audience. And whether we like it or not, there's a kind of snobbery in design which says, oh, if it's for a mass audience, it can't be good. But he is living proof that it can be good.
And let's launch into some of that variety, some of those different projects. And if we look through the book, whether it's Minnesota Zoo, again, kind of expressing the very kind of simplistic shape. So, you know, as you'd expect in a wayfinding scheme or system for a zoo, it's very much animal-based, wonderful graphics of the different animals. Then skipping through, he did work for Jeddah Airport in the 70s, very kind of avant-garde, very sort of influenced by the surroundings. Then through that to the Washington Mall wayfinding systems and the Washington Metro also, classic sort of Americana post-war, late sort of 70s systems there. But then there is the Mexico 68, and that's the famous one.
De 1968, declaro inaugurados los Juegos Olímpicos de México.
The book, what's amazing, and we see pictures of his studio and the sort of development from it, from a sort of compass, circular, anatomical almost sort of design drawing to what it became. Tell us about that section of the book and how you edited it.
Okay, well, the Mexico thing is really interesting because the thing to remember, he did it in 1968 when he was in his early 20s. He graduated very weirdly as from the Pratt Institute in New York. He graduated as a product designer. But something drew him towards graphics and visual expression. And so he abandoned product design and became a graphic designer. And he took a one-way ticket with his brand new wife of only a few weeks, took a one-way ticket to Mexico to effectively pitch for the Mexico job. He had 2 weeks in which to convince the Mexican guys that he was the right man for the job. And there was some resistance because he wasn't Mexican and, you know. So down he went and he spent the first week in the Museum of Anthropology. And he just soaked up traditional pre-Hispanic art before the Spanish colonization, Aztec and Mayan art, and then the sort of contemporary folk art, which still, or certainly in the 60s, was going on in Mexico. So he absorbed all these influences. Plus, before he left New York to go for this, to try and get this job, he visited a very famous op art show in 60s New York. And so what he did in Mexico was a fusion of Mexican art and op art, plus his own sensibility. And the other big thing to remember, and you touched on it when you talked about animal motifs and stuff, he had to do something for the Olympics that was non-language based. Levels at that time in 68, literacy levels were quite low in Mexico. Plus, there was a huge, as any Olympic Games, we got a huge influx of people from all over the world. So he developed this, and I think this is really one of his great claims to fame. He developed a way of communicating visually, which was non-linguistic. And he tells a great story, because he's a fantastic storyteller. He tells a great story of driving down the West Way in New York, and he saw the first ads for the iPod, which were the silhouettes against vivid colors, just silhouettes of people dancing, the white.
The earphones.
And he nearly crashed his car because it was exactly what he did in Mexico. And then a bit later, when the iPhone came out and the icons, they are astonishingly similar to what he did. Now, who can say whether Apple were influenced or not? But it would be hard to argue that they weren't. And the reason that I think someone like Apple would look at this and say how fantastic is because it's non-language based. It's image based. And again, I think maybe that's another reason why he's been neglected, because a lot of his work doesn't include type. It's just visual. It's as exactly as you said. It's animal heads and stuff. But it communicates. And that's his obsession. His obsession is with really effective communication. So I mentioned earlier the mass audience. He's a designer who always works for a mass audience. But he communicates in a way that, through his use of color and form, is really effective. He communicates properly and effectively.
That was Adrian Shaughnessy, co-founder of Unit Editions, on the new book he has published, Lance Wyman, The Monograph, which will be at many of the world's good bookshops as of next week. You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. And now we turn our attention to a city that is not much accustomed to big contemporary architectural projects. Jerusalem, the ancient, divided, and often tense spiritual centre of the Holy Land, is also Israel's second city and a major centre for commerce and services. Ancient sites, early churches, and later eclectic edifices, all in limestone, dominate, so news that the mayor's office had approved for a tall building to be built right by the old Yehuda market, known as the Shuk, caused some consternation. Well, early in the summer, designs of world-famous Polish-born architect Daniel Libeskind, in collaboration with local Israeli architect Yigal Levy, were chosen for the new building. The Pyramid Tower will be a 26-storey, 200-metre, mixed-use development, featuring 200 luxury apartments, a hotel and a rooftop restaurant. Given the location, special treatment has been given to the stone facades of the tower, where obligatory limestone cladding dominates. But how does Libeskind answer those critics that say that the project is out of scale and inappropriate for this most sensitive of cities? Earlier, I spoke to the man himself, on the line from our New York bureau.
First of all, it's a project that I've worked on for many years. There was two previous clients, and finally, the third client. And we already had planning permission for a building of that height on this central area of Jerusalem. Now, where it is built, where to be built, is the Machane Yehuda market. It's the big shuk. It's the market of Jerusalem. It's a dense urban area. It is an area that is developing rapidly. There are at least four other large-scale projects which are being built or in planning stages. And this is an unusual project because it's a mixed-use project, creating a really enormous public space, a main piazza, really, that Jerusalem badly needs, in a neighborhood which is really a kind of rundown neighborhood. It's right at Agrippa Street and King George, but the area is very, very rundown and badly neglected, and of course needs development. So this is a mixed-use project which creates really a magnificent public space, piazza. It is, of course, also a residential building with not only luxury apartments, but also 20% of the building is affordable housing. It has a large component of retail and commerce. It has a museum in it. It has also a restaurant. And most importantly, at the very tip of the pyramid, there's a public space, an incredible observatory from which you can see 360 degrees, the beautiful panoramas of Jerusalem. So it's really a very urban project with a very urban mix of activities, living, shopping, working. And the building itself is very permeable. You can actually move from the piazza through the building into the city itself. So it's also kind of a gateway.
So you sound very well equipped to answer my next question on how you might answer concerns on whether this project is actually appropriate. It's obviously a very sensitive urban and historic context. I mean, do you feel ready to answer any of those criticisms?
Well, first of all, I want to say that some years ago, I have already received a planning permission for a building of this height. So it's not something new. It's not as if it is going beyond the height that has already been approved 5 years ago, 7 years ago. The building is not too tall. On the contrary, because of its massing, because the pyramid, of course, is reducing itself to a point at its apex, the building does not throw shadows that a normal extruded building would throw, and is a very elegant and memorable form in the skyline of the city, very delicate. So it's a building that will certainly not overpower the historical texture, but will, I think, enhance the beauty of Jerusalem and its skyline.
And on a personal level, Daniel, what does it mean for you to be on this location, to be involved in this project? How many large projects like this must come up in such a special city like Jerusalem? It must be quite important for you.
Well, it's really, you know, how lucky can one be to be building in the historical center of Jerusalem something that is really a dramatic building that will enhance people's lives, will enhance Jerusalem, will be an attraction not only to people who live there or who shop there or who go to the museum, but it will be really an attraction to visitors from around the world. And I think it's remarkable. How often does one get a chance to build a building of that sort in the heart of an incredible city like Jerusalem? Maybe once in a lifetime. That's it. So yes, I'm very lucky and I'm looking forward to completing the project.
And perhaps can you just tell us a little bit about the collaboration? You're working with an Israeli architect who's been involved. Maybe, you know, what kinds of conversations, what kind of dialogue with the team there have you been having?
Well, in every project that we undertake anywhere in the world, you know, whether it's in Singapore or whether it's in, you know, Berlin or wherever it is, we always work with a local knowledge, because you can't just come in and just decide what you're doing. You have to have a collaboration that is able to navigate through all the complexity of the city and be able to also help you really on the ground. The building is really will be built with Jerusalem stone and with glass. And the requirement there is 50-50%. That's the regulation in Jerusalem. And so one has to come up with very interesting uses of stone, uses of glass, in order to make the building not only work in terms of the sunlight and the angles of light in this beautiful city, but also create a really contemporary building, a contemporary expression of the energy of Jerusalem that is based on the tradition of the city, but also gives some new impetus to the development of this capital city.
That was me in conversation with architect Daniel Libeskind on the subject of his newly approved project, The Pyramid in Jerusalem. Coming up on the show, we turn our design gaze from the Middle East to the North Atlantic and to Iceland, where one women's wear designer wants to ensure that her outfits are both elegant and more environmentally sustainable. And then we hear from two Detroit-based entrepreneurs who designed an ingenious piece of furniture. All still to come on Section D with me, David Pleasant.
Great design tells stories, and Squarespace's innovative website building tool is the perfect platform from which to tell them beautifully. Showcase your creativity, ideas, and business in style with Squarespace's unrivaled range of online products and services. To see how it could work for you and for a 10% discount, head to squarespace.com and enter the promotion code Monocle. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
You're listening to Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now we head to Reykjavik, Iceland's windswept and increasingly fashion-conscious capital. As this tiny nation's banking crash of 2008 took effect, it gave many of the country's young creatives time and opportunity to take stock of their strengths, passions, and local talents. A feeling that an economy based on limitless, expensive imports was over and a new, more considerate and vernacular language, whether it be in the field of design or otherwise, emerged. One such creative was Dutch-Icelandic fashion designer Jette Korinner, who makes her own garments in the basement-cum-studio beneath her Gloria concept store on Reykjavik's smart Laugavegur shopping street. Last week, I went into Jette's basement to talk textiles and how to dye them.
Iceland was having its worldly known crisis. At that time, I was actually working as a freelancer, and from one day to the other, basically, I had no work anymore. There was nothing to do anymore. Everything shut down within a week. And while sitting in my studio, I figured I had no other excuse than to maybe just make some garments. Those garments were natural dyed. Because of natural dye being sensitive to light, that function was used to bleach them out. So in a really nice way, the shops that were carrying that line got stickers of hands in the window. Two hands making the famous animals, like the shadow animals on the wall. They would hang up the pieces behind those stickers, behind the window, basically. And the print on the window would then spare out the print on the shirt.
Dyeing using sunlight.
I was using the Midsummer Night. And that collection got really popular and marked out the beginning of my brand. I figured out that even in time of crisis, this was something to consider working on, because at the end, everything was produced in Iceland, dyed in Iceland, washed in ocean, Icelandic ocean. So I didn't need foreign currency or import to continue.
Can we go next door into the workshop and see where it all starts, how it's made?
Yeah.
There's several sewing machines in here. there's two hobs that are attached to a basin. So this looks like a professional dyeing unit, really.
I can see here there's a couple of scraps still laying around.
Different turquoise, blues, greens. They sort of mark out your palette, would you say?
In this case, yeah. But we have actually, the palette of natural dyes are, it's amazing how diverse it is. And you can steer one particular dye in different colors by using different mordanting. It's a bit of witchcraft, you know. We do feel like that when these sessions are going on, it's the part of our company that still feels very artistic.
Do you find these colors are very hard to replicate? You'll get a different result in each batch.
I cannot replicate. Every time we heat up the pot, something new could happen. And not only that, if a pot stands for 2 days, he has changed already color. Because the natural dyes is like a soup, basically. And when you have it stand for 2 days, then the pH within that pot changes because of rotting, basically. These techniques are like, they take a lot of work, and there was too much speed in selling and our production could not keep up. This could also not be done by a factory abroad. Not only would that break the whole concept of the company. And so we decided to like slow down our own production where we could handle it and rather look for other brands to complement the store part, the selling part of our brand. And that resulted in what's happening upstairs, the store upstairs called Gloria.
Should we go up and have a look?
Yes, we're gonna. There's a lot of girls laughing now, I hear.
It's a sleek showroom, very minimalist. You haven't gone in for too much decoration in any way, just no, low.
I would strip it even more if I could. It's always too much for me. If it was up to me, then it would be packed with clothes, but nothing else, really.
Let's look at some of the collections. What you'd like to show us?
This here is a signature piece of our own brand. This is called a life coat. And what you would call a life coat is when you combine a blanket with leather sleeves. And with that, you kind of create the ultimate wrapping jacket device, if you want to.
Perfect winter wear.
Yeah. This is actually an idea that when you live in a cold country like Iceland, the locals definitely do not want to be wrapped up in outdoor clothes for the rest of their life.
I have to say that the amount of raincoats and winter coats on the streets of Reykjavik is quite astounding, but maybe that's mainly tourists. Icelandic women like to wear something a little bit more special?
Yeah, we completely tried to reinvent outdoor in a fashionable way all year round, because otherwise we would be covered up in Gore-Tex for the rest of our lives in bright red and blue or something.
And that isn't much fun when the weather isn't so reliable all year round. You really don't want to wear something super practical every day.
No, it's a bit of where I think we get our specialization. We're trying to make warm clothes or which still look good or having a function. So what we use a lot in my brand is removable linings into things or removable sheepskins inside that you can like upgrade your jacket to winter and then you can downgrade it back to summer and keep on using that particular item. The philosophy of the store upstairs is buy less but buy better quality. So upgrading a jacket or changing between seasons very much fits into the philosophy of this store.
That was me there taking a tour of the workshop and shop of fashion designer Jette Korinna in Reykjavik. This is Section D with me, David Pleasant. Now to the fresh-thinking, forward-facing and truly inspirational world of our sister show here on Monocle 24, The Entrepreneurs. On the last episode of the show, Danny Giacopelli met Detroit manufacturing duo Kyle Hoff and Alex O'Dell, who are the founders of Kickstarter-funded company Floyd, which makes a simple yet effective device, the Floyd Leg. Steel contraptions that allow you, with a nifty vice-like feature, to create a table from any surface you like. In an edited excerpt of their interview, the Floyd team explained their design process.
We were both living in the same apartment building across the street from this garage. In Kyle's bedroom, they weren't called the Floyd Leg at the time, but it was a really interesting design, in that he was using his door from his apartment and had made a desk from it by clamping on these legs. And it seemed to be something that could be very useful for people that are moving a lot between different spaces, different apartments, that you could just take the legs with you and find a surface material when you get to a new place. And so we started talking about how could we get this out there? How could we start to share this design with people? And Kickstarter seemed to be, you know, an interesting kind of route for doing that, about seeing, is this something that people are actually going to be interested in?
Did you start from the beginning saying, we're going to build this in Detroit and its environs? Or did you kind of say, you know, maybe we'll manufacture it in China?
No, I mean, it was always the pieces, and the pieces we even design now are all very much about designing within sort of the processes of what manufacturers are already doing. So we don't necessarily like design products that are, you know, just coming out of our heads and whatever, but it's about going to the facilities, seeing how they produce what they're producing now, whether it be automobile parts or parts for tractors or whatever they are, and seeing like what kind of processes could work within a sort of design concept that we're already running with. So it was very much like about that partnership from the get-go. And yes, I mean, obviously it'd be easy to get things produced in China, but I think there's something that we really value in those partnerships and sort of the history of the manufacturers that are already there. I mean, some date back to the early 1900s. And
yeah. Right. So who is Floyd?
So Floyd is...
Besides your company.
Yeah. Floyd is the name of my my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather, all kind of who worked in steel mills in Youngstown, Ohio. So the name kind of harkens back to that. And it started, I mean, like my great-grandfather, the first Floyd, he moved to Youngstown, Ohio to start Republic Steel, which was a huge steel mill there from some, I think, Virginia or something like that. And since it's been sort of a series of Floyds, and my mom kind of put a end to the name when I came around, it was...
This is your way of making up for the fact that you weren't named Floyd.
Exactly.
you're cementing the Floyd legacy. So tell me about the products you're launching now, this month in the summer.
This week, actually, we're releasing some new products. We have the Floyd Coat Rack, which is very simple, assemblable coat rack. You know, it takes a real staple of an apartment, and it's a pretty curious design. Also, we're doing tabletop objects. So we have the Floyd candle holder, the Floyd mail drop, and the Floyd book clips.
The bench as well. We kind of, a bench is an extension on sort of the table idea, where it's a set of four legs that clamp to any flat surface. It's also been sort of interesting. People have been asking for it, and it's something we were planning on doing. We see sort of a lot of other applications for it as well. I mean, it's definitely a bench, but it sort of has the ability to adapt into something like a day bed or coffee table. And I think for any apartment, it's great to have pieces that can be more than one thing. I mean, not everybody needs a dedicated bench, but people might need a bench or a coffee table or something they can use when they have guests. And that's kind of the goal of a lot of the products, whether it be like the coat rack. It's great to throw your coat and hat on, but it also works well as a piece to extend for when you have guests over, for them to hang their clothes on, and things of that nature and that vein, so that people in apartments can really, you know, live comfortably. And it isn't about like having this one amazing piece in there, but it's about having pieces that allow you to sort of embrace the lifestyle you already have.
That was Danny Giacopelli speaking to Detroit design duo and entrepreneurs Kyle Hoff and Alex Odell. You can hear the full interview on Danny's business-themed show, The Entrepreneurs. And that's all we have time for on this episode of Section D with me, David Pleasant. We'll be back at the same time next week. If you've missed any of this week's show, or for our back catalogue, you can head to monocle.com, SoundCloud, or iTunes to listen again. The show was put together by Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries or questions, you can contact me, David Pleasant, at dmp@monocle.com. As always, thanks for listening and goodbye.